the area of defense. The great support in the area of defense includes the security assistance passed by this Congress on a bipartisan basis that Donald Trump held up in violation of the law. Immediately after President Zelensky raised the issue of defense support, President Trump responded, "I would like you to do us a favor, though." These words will live in infamy. First, President Trump said to President Zelensky, as part of the two demands that he requested, "I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation in Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike. I guess you have one of your wealthy people, the server, they say, Ukraine has it." President Trump continued, "I would like to have the Attorney General call you or your people, and I would like you to get to the bottom of it. As you saw yesterday, that whole nonsense ended with a very poor performance by a man named Robert Mueller, a Vietnam War hero, by the way. A very poor performance by a man named Robert Mueller, an incompetent performance. But they say a lot of it started with Ukraine. Whatever you can do, it's a very important that you do it if that's possible." Who is the they referred to by President Trump putting forth the baseless conspiracy theory that the Ukrainians, not the Russians, were behind the hack of the Democratic National Committee server in 2016? They means Russia. They means Putin. They are enemies of the United States. Not a single witness who testified before the House knew of any factual basis for President Trump's belief in the CrowdStrike Ukraine fairy tale. To the contrary, the U.S. intelligence community and this Senate Intelligence Committee.
Live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248 BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and 90.7 KPFK in Los Angeles. Currently, we're listening to impeachment manager, Democratic Representative Hakeem Jeffries.
Security services. The conspiracy theory that President Trump advanced on the July 25th phone call is stone cold Russian propaganda. As early as February 2017, Vladimir Putin began to promote this lie during a press conference saying, quote, "The Ukrainian government adopted a unilateral position in favor of one candidate. More than that, certain oligarchs, certainly with the approval of the political leadership, funded this candidate, or female candidate, to be precise." Those are the words of Vladimir Putin, a script apparently adopted by President Donald John Trump. If there was any doubt about who benefits from this unfounded Russian-inspired conspiracy theory advanced by Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin made it clear when he said in November of 2019, "Thank God no one is accusing us anymore of interfering in U.S. elections. Now they're accusing Ukrainians." Unfortunately, this is not the first time President Trump tried to capitalize on Russian propaganda and misinformation for his own political benefit. On July 24th, just one day before this call, Special Counsel Robert Mueller testified before Congress that the Russian government interfered in the 2016 election in sweeping and systematic fashion in order to support the Trump campaign and divide America. Mr. Mueller also found that the Trump campaign welcomed Russian interference in the 2016 election and utilized it as part of its campaign messaging. Despite the clear and overwhelming conclusion of U.S. intelligence agencies, as well as the distinguished Senate Intelligence Committee, that Russia, not Ukraine, interfered in the 2016 election, President Trump continued to press the new Ukrainian leader to announce an investigation into the CrowdStrike Ukraine conspiracy theory. Why? President Trump sought a political favor. That's why. As part of a scheme to solicit foreign interference in the 2020 election. The second demand made by President Trump on the July 25th call related to the campaign of Vice President Joe Biden, who announced his intention to run for the office of the presidency last April. Throughout the spring and early summer of last year, public polling consistently showed that Biden would decisively defeat President Trump. In fact, on June 16th of last year, June 16th, a Fox News poll showed that President Trump would lose to Joe Biden by 10 points. The concern with Joe Biden's candidacy provides motive for President Trump's demand that the Ukrainian government investigate the former vice president and his son, Hunter. Here is what President Trump said on that call. The other thing, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution. And a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the Attorney General would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution. So if you can look into it, it sounds horrible to me. Now, the Trump administration officials who participated in the impeachment inquiry unanimously testified that there was no factual support for the allegation that Vice President Biden did anything wrong or misused his authority when he pressed for the removal of Ukraine's corrupt former prosecutor general. Joe Biden did nothing wrong. The witnesses testified that Vice President Biden was in fact carrying out official U.S. policy to clean up the prosecutor general's office in Ukraine. This policy, of course, aligned with the perspective of many in this very distinguished body, as well as our European allies throughout the world, as well as the International Monetary Fund. Vice President Biden did not remove Yuri Lutsenko, the corrupt prosecutor. The Ukrainian government did, with the support of the free world. Nonetheless, on October 3rd, 2019, when a reporter asked President Trump, "What exactly did you hope Zelensky would do about the Bidens after your phone call?" President Trump responded as follows.
"Mr. President, what exactly did you hope Zelensky would do about the Bidens Well, I would think that if they were honest about it, they'd start a major investigation into the Biden. It's a very simple answer.
Start a major investigation into the Bidens. The evidence of wrongdoing by President Trump is hiding in plain sight. During the July 25th call, President Trump also repeatedly pressed the Ukrainian president to coordinate with his personal attorney, Rudolph Giuliani. Why was Rudolph Giuliani's name mentioned multiple times during the July 25th phone call? Giuliani is not the Secretary of State. He's not an ambassador. He's not a member of the diplomatic corps. Rudolph Giuliani is a cold-blooded political operative for President Trump's re-election campaign. That is why he was referenced multiple times on that July 25th phone call. And it is evidence of corrupt intent by President Trump. By the time the call took place, President Zelensky understood Giuliani's connection to the shakedown scheme. He recognized Giuliani's role as the president's political operative as matters related to Ukraine. Zelensky informed President Trump that one of his aides spoke with Mr. Giuliani just recently, and we are hoping very much that Mr. Giuliani will be able to travel to Ukraine and we will meet once he comes. The Ukrainian leader knew Giuliani represented President Trump's political interest in his country and could help unlock the long sought after Oval Office meeting that President Zelensky desired. The phony investigation sought by President Trump on the July 25th call were not designed to bolster the national security interests of the United States of America. Quite the contrary, President Trump sought to benefit himself and his own re-election prospects. On a July 25th call, President Trump also suggested that President Zelensky speak with the Attorney General, William Barr, about the two fake investigations that the president sought. This is important to keep in mind. At no time during this entire sordid scheme was there an ongoing American law enforcement investigation into the phony slander related to Joe Biden or the conspiracy theory related to Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election. At no time was there an ongoing American law enforcement investigation. America is the leader of the free world. We do not urge other sovereign countries to target American citizens, absent any legitimate basis whatsoever, absent any scintilla of evidence. Apparently, President Trump does not play by those rules. During the July 25th call, President Trump didn't raise legitimate corruption concerns as it relates to Ukraine. President Trump did not mention the word corruption once. The president did, however, viciously malign former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, a distinguished anti-corruption advocate whom he abruptly removed because she was seen as an obstacle to his geopolitical shakedown. Ambassador Yovanovitch joined the diplomatic corps under President Ronald Reagan in and subsequently served three other Republican presidents. She is a highly respected diplomat and foreign service professional. Yet, President Trump told the new Ukrainian leader, the former ambassador from the United States, the woman, was bad news. And the people she was dealing with in the Ukraine were bad news. So I just want to let you know that. He didn't stop there. Later in the call, President Trump ominously added, well, she's going to go through some things. These are the words of the President of the United States of America. Ambassador Yovanovitch did not know of President Trump's disparaging remarks at the time. She didn't learn of them until the call record became public in September. Asked whether she felt threatened by President Trump's statement that she was going to go through some things, Ambassador Yovanovitch answered that she did. Here is what she said.
The next excerpt, when the president references you, was a short one. But he said, well, she's going to go through some things. What did you think when President Trump told President Zelensky and you read that you were going to go through some things?
I didn't know what to think, but I was very concerned.
What were you concerned about?
She's going to go through some things. It didn't sound good. It sounded like a threat.
Did you feel threatened?
I did.
During that same call, President Trump also took the opportunity to praise Yuri Lutsenko. Mr. Lutsenko is the former Ukrainian prosecutor general who was widely regarded by the entire free world, including our European allies and the International Monetary Fund, to be corrupt and incompetent. But Donald John Trump, our president, praised him on that call. He told President Zelensky, quote, I heard you had a prosecutor who was very good and he was shut down. And that's really unfair. A lot of people are talking about that, the way they shut your very good prosecutor down. And you had some very bad people involved. Think about this contrast. The president bashed a career American diplomat, an anti-corruption champion, who he unceremoniously removed because she was viewed as an obstacle to his efforts to solicit foreign interference in the 2020 election, and at the same time, praised someone who he thought could be an asset, a corrupt Ukrainian prosecutor, who the free world viewed as an obstacle to the rule of law. The idea that President Trump cares about corruption is laughable. It's laughable. Plain reading of the rough transcript of the July 25th call also sheds light on the quid pro quo involving the Oval Office meeting that had been sought. President Zelensky said on the call, I also wanted to thank you for your invitation to visit the United States, specifically Washington, D.C. On the other hand, I also wanted to ensure that we will be very serious about the case and will work on the investigation. As all of you know, here in this distinguished body, quid pro quo is a Latin term. It means this for that. Statement that I just read shows that President Zelensky fully understood at the time of this July 25th call that if he yielded to President Trump's demand for phony investigations, he would get the White House meeting in the Oval Office that he desperately sought. This for that. President Trump has repeatedly insisted that his July 25th conversation with President Zelensky was a perfect call. His staff at the White House apparently believed otherwise. The press office issued a short and incomplete summary of the July 25th call. Let me read it for your hearing. Today, President Donald J. Trump spoke by telephone with President Vladimir Zelensky of Ukraine to congratulate him on his recent
Sergeant in arms will restore order in the gallery.
Protests have erupted. I say erupted, at least have occurred in the Senate Lord gallery. Didn't quite catch what was saying. Again, this is Democratic Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York, one of the floor managers.
This is a White House call readout, July 25th. 2019. Today, President Donald J. Trump spoke by telephone with President Vladimir Zelensky of Ukraine to congratulate him on his recent election. President Trump and President Zelensky discussed ways to strengthen the relationship between the United States and Ukraine, including energy and economic cooperation. Both leaders also expressed that they look forward to the opportunity to meet. That is the official White House call readout dated July 25th, 2019. The official readout provided to the American people omitted key elements of the president's conversation. Let's review. The official readout did not mention the phony investigations requested by President Trump. The official readout did not mention the Oval Office meeting sought by President Zelensky. The official readout did not mention President Trump's elevation of a debunked conspiracy theory promoted by Vladimir Putin about 2016 election interference. The official readout did not mention President Trump's demand that Ukraine investigate his domestic political rival, Joe Biden. The official readout did not mention that President Trump maligned and threatened Ambassador Yovanovitch. And the official readout did not mention that President Trump praised a corrupt former Ukrainian prosecutor. The complete conversation, however, between President Trump and President Zelensky that we just outlined offers powerful evidence that President Trump abused his power and solicited foreign interference in the 2016 election, the 2020 election. Several members of the president's staff listening in on the call immediately grew concerned. As he sat in the White House Situation Room listening to the conversation, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman realized that the president's demands of the Ukrainian leader were inappropriate and improper. He quickly recognized that as the president began referencing the Bidens and CrowdStrike, the call was diverging from the official National Security Council approved talking points that he helped prepare. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, 20-year Iraq War veteran, Purple Heart recipient, and American patriot. He testified in the context of the call that due to the unequal bargaining position of the two leaders and Ukraine's dependence on the United States, the favor that President Trump sought would have been perceived by President Zelensky as a demand. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman worried that the call would undermine U.S. national security interests, and he knew immediately that he had a duty to report the contents of the call to White House lawyers.
I was concerned by the call. What I heard was inappropriate, and I reported my concerns to Mr. Eisenberg. It is improper for the President of the United States to demand a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen and a political opponent. I was also clear that if Ukraine pursued an investigation, into the 2016 elections, the Bidens and Burisma, it would be interpreted as a partisan play. This would undoubtedly result in Ukraine losing bipartisan support, undermining U.S. national security, and advancing Russia's strategic objectives in the region.
Recounting the content of the call based on his detailed handwritten notes, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman told the lawyers that he believed it was wrong for President Trump to ask President Zelensky to investigate Vice President Biden. Other witnesses were also troubled by what they heard. Vice President Pence's advisor, Jennifer Williams, expressed concern that President Trump raised a domestic political matter on an official call with a foreign leader. She testified that the mention of investigations struck her as unusual and possibly political in nature. She said, "I guess for me, it shed some light on possible other motives behind a security assistance hold." Timothy Morrison, a former Republican congressional staffer who replaced Dr. Fiona Hill in July of 2019, also reported the call to National Security Council lawyers. After the call, President Trump continued to push the scheme forward. On July 26, the very next day, Ambassador Sondland and Ambassador Taylor met with President Zelensky and other Ukrainian officials in Kyiv. According to David Holmes, the Ukraine-based U.S. diplomat who served as the note taker, the Ukrainian leader mentioned that President Trump had brought up some very sensitive issues during the July 25th call. Very sensitive issues. Ambassador Sondland then had a private meeting with Andrei Yermak, President Zelensky's top aide. The two men insisted that the meeting be one-on-one with no note taker, perhaps due to the sensitive issues that might come up. Ambassador Sondland testified that he and President Zelensky's aide probably discussed the issue of investigations. After these key moments in Ukraine, Ambassador Sondland went to lunch with David Holmes and two other American officials. Mr. Holmes sat directly across from Ambassador Sondland, close enough to hear the details of an extraordinary telephone call between Mr. Sondland and President Trump. As Mr. Holmes relayed during his sworn testimony under oath, Ambassador Sondland pulled out his unsecured cell phone and said that he was going to call President Trump to give him an update. What happened next was shocking.
While Ambassador Sondland's phone was not on speakerphone, I could hear the president's voice through the earpiece of the phone. The president's voice was loud and recognizable. And Ambassador Sondland held the phone away from his ear for a period of time, presumably because of the loud volume. I heard Ambassador Sondland greet the president and explain he was calling from Kyiv. I heard President Trump then clarify that Ambassador Sondland was in Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland replied, yes, he was in Ukraine, and went on to state that President Zelensky, quote, loves your ass. I then heard President Trump ask, so he's going to do the investigation. Ambassador Sondland replied that he's going to do it, adding that President Zelensky will do anything you ask him to do.
He's going to do it. He will do anything you ask him to do. Immediately after this call with President Trump, Mr. Holmes followed up with Ambassador Sondland.
After the call ended, Ambassador Sondland remarked that the president was in a bad mood. As Ambassador Sondland stated, it was often the case early in the morning. I then took the opportunity to ask Ambassador Sondland for his candid impression of the president's views on Ukraine. In particular, I asked Ambassador Sondland if it was true that the president did not give a expletive about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland agreed that the president did not give an expletive about Ukraine. I asked why not. And Ambassador Sondland stated that the president only cares about big stuff. I noted there was big stuff going on in Ukraine, like a war with Russia. And Ambassador Sondland replied that he meant big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani was pushing. The conversation then moved on to other topics.
During the July 25th call, President Trump asked for the favor of these two phony political investigations immediately after the Ukrainian president brought up defense assistance for Ukraine. And the following day, Ambassador Sondland confirmed to President Trump that Ukraine would indeed initiate the investigations discussed on the call, which was the only thing President cared about with respect to Ukraine. He didn't care that Russia was forcefully occupying eastern Ukraine. President Trump didn't care that thousands of Ukrainians apparently have died fighting for their democracy. He didn't seem to care that supporting Ukraine bolsters America's national security. But he cared about himself as it relates to the prospects of his reelection in 2020. In November, President Trump denied that he spoke to Ambassador Sondland on July 26, telling reporters, I know nothing about that. But in his public testimony, Ambassador Sondland contradicted that assertion with official records he obtained from the White House. Ambassador Sondland further explained that Holmes's testimony refreshed his reelection about the July 26 call, which Ambassador Sondland had not originally described when he first appeared at a deposition before the House.
Also, on July 26, shortly after our Kyiv meetings, I spoke by phone with President Trump. The White House, which has finally shared certain call dates and times with my attorneys, confirms this. The call lasted 5 minutes. I remember I was at a restaurant in Kyiv, and I have no reason to doubt that this conversation included the subject of investigations. Again, given Mr. Giuliani's demand that President Zelensky make a public statement about investigations, I knew that investigations were important to President Trump.
President Trump said that his July 25th conversation was a perfect call. It was far from perfect. In a perfect call, the president would not demand a political favor from a vulnerable Ukraine under attack by a Russian foe. In a perfect call, the president would not demand that a foreign leader investigate a Russian-inspired conspiracy about the 2016 election. In a perfect call, the president would not pressure a foreign government to target an American citizen for political personal gain. In a perfect call, the president would not solicit foreign interference in the 2020 election. In a perfect call, the president would not threaten the well-being of a highly respected American ambassador and say that she was going to go through some things. In a perfect call, the president would not praise a disgraced former prosecutor who the free world viewed as corrupt and incompetent. And in a perfect call, the president would not have directed a foreign leader to follow up with Rudolph Giuliani, a human hand grenade. This was not a perfect call. It is direct evidence that President Donald John Trump corruptly abused his power and solicited foreign interference in the 2020 election.
The majority leader is recognized.
Mr. Chief Justice, colleagues, we'll now take a 30-minute break for dinner and reconvene at 7:05. So I ask consent the Senate stand in recess until that time.
Without objection, so ordered.
And you have been listening to live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald J. Trump. I'm Mitch Jezerich, coming to you from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. Currently, as you heard, the Senate is taking a dinner break of 30 minutes, but I will tell you what, they have not stayed within the time confines of any of their planned breaks, and I would anticipate that 30 minutes could go much longer than planned. So allow me to take this quick moment to tell you what our broadcasting plans are for the next hour and 20 minutes. We are going to wrap up this show at 5 p.m. of our live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial to make way for flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 6 p.m., you will have the KPFA evening news. And I trust during both of those programs, you will get updates as well as the news of the day concerning the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. What we are going to do for the next hour and 20 minutes or so is we are going to have analysis. We're going to have a number of guests who are going to join us, including Elizabeth Holtzman, who's a former congressional member from New York. She was actually a member of the House Judiciary Committee that was investigating the Watergate scandal and became a major committee for the impeachment process of Richard Nixon. She's going to join us here momentarily. We're also going to be joined by John Boniface, who is the author of the book, The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. And then furthermore, we're going to hear a conversation I had with R. Jeffrey Smith of the Center for Public Integrity. He is the reporter through a FOIA request that obtained 300 emails between the Office of Management and Budget and the Department of Defense, showing that the Department of Defense was very worried about the potential of breaking the law, breaking the Impoundment Control Act of 1974 that says and that the Department of Defense was very worried that they were breaking that law as the Office of Management and Budget was refusing to allow the military aid to be sent to Ukraine. So we're going to talk to him about his FOIA request and the documents that we have and the further documents that they're trying to get with Jeffrey Smith. And that's probably going to be about a half hour from now or so. And then after all of our guests, we are going to open up our phones until 5 o'clock to allow you to weigh in and give your opinion concerning the impeachment trial, impeachment all, you know, in general, and even if you have some questions. Now, I'm not a professor, I am not an expert, but this is basically all that I have been talking about since October, and I've learned a great deal. So if you have any questions that I might be able to answer, I would be happy to be able to try to do that. Now, today is really the first day of oral arguments in the impeachment trial. the Democrats have used now just under 5 hours of their allotted 24 hours that they have to make their case between now and the end of Friday. Then on Saturday, the Trump's defense team will begin to make its case of why Donald Trump should be acquitted. They, too, will have 24 hours in total over 3 days that will end on Tuesday. However, it's not really anticipated that Trump's team is going to use the entire 24 hours. In fact, we haven't heard and we will not hear from Trump's team today, tomorrow, or even on Friday, because all we are hearing from is the House floor managers who are, you know, acting as the prosecutors. We won't hear from Donald Trump's team until Saturday. Yet, if you had watched or listened or joined us yesterday for the debate over the rules of the Senate, which the debates were basically between the House floor managers and Trump's defense team, you heard that Trump's team didn't take up a lot of time in that debate. They didn't even come near. They didn't come close to using the time they were given to debate the rules, and that we were mostly hearing from the House floor managers. So that is. So I don't actually anticipate that we are going to hear all 24 hours worth of oral arguments from Trump's defense team, though we will see. And then after that entire process wraps up, then we will have 16 hours of senator questions that will be read by Chief Justice John Roberts, who is presiding over the trial. I anticipate that taking a couple of days next week. And after that occurs, then we'll be at an important moment in this trial in which the Senate will decide whether or not to call witnesses for the trial. And there will be a whole process behind that. It's going to be much more complicated than, okay, we're now going to have witnesses. We can get into those complications a little bit later. And then they're also going to vote whether or not to allow additional evidence into the trial, especially a lot of the evidence that has been learned ever after Donald Trump was impeached by the House of Representatives. We're going to talk about some of that information and additional evidence that has emerged after the impeachment with our Jeffrey Smith of the Center for Public Integrity here in about a half hour or so. Before we get to our first guest, Elizabeth Holtzman, let me just tell you that I'd like to make an appeal to you to ask you for your support of this broadcast. We are public broadcasters. We rely on you and listeners like you to support what we do here. And in order for us to be able to continue to do the coverage of the Senate impeachment trial by bringing you a vast majority of the actual proceedings from the Senate, and then provide analysis, and even providing analysis from people with different points of view. If you appreciate the historical perspective that we include in these broadcasts, if you appreciate the legal analysis that we provide, if you appreciate what we are trying to do here, well, we hadn't budgeted for it, right? It's not part of the budget. So what we need to be able to do in order for us to continue to be able to do these broadcasts during the duration of the Senate impeachment trial is ask you for your support and a donation, really whatever you can afford, what is according to your own means, something you feel good about as you go upon your day, knowing that you did your part. The number to make that contribution is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. So again, it's kind of our way of passing around the hat, asking you if you could just throw whatever you have available to help us in our endeavor to continue to cover this very important moment in history. This is only the third time that a U.S. president has been impeached, third time has been impeached, but only the third time we've actually had a trial of a president in the Senate. This is the Constitution coming alive, and it's an important moment, and it will also be very important where we are on the other side of this moment. So again, asking you to support us any way you can. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. KPFA.org. Okay, let's get to the analysis. And joining us on the telephone now is Elizabeth Holtzman. Elizabeth Holtzman is a former congressional member from New York. She served on the House Judiciary Committee that investigated the Watergate scandal and prepared articles of impeachment that would really bring the resignation of President Richard Nixon. Her latest book is called The Case for Impeaching Trump. Elizabeth Holtzman, I thank you greatly for your time.
No, thank you for having me.
Good to have you. So I guess you never got to this point back in 1974, an actual Senate trial, because Richard Nixon had resigned beforehand. You know, a few months ago, I was in Washington, D.C., and I spent time with Betty Coed, who is the official Senate historian. And she told me, even though that there wasn't an actual trial for Richard Nixon in 1974, that the Senate, and especially her office, had done an incredible amount of work in preparing for a potential trial, because they didn't realize Nixon was going to resign. They thought there was going to be a trial. And that, in fact, a lot of their work actually paid off some 25 years later when they finally had a trial for Bill Clinton.
Well, I'm not aware of those preparations by the Senate. All I can say is that there are some things that are really relevant to this proceeding from the Nixon proceeding, even though we did not go to a Senate trial because Nixon resigned. One of the critical arguments that the Republicans are making at this point is that about witnesses, about documents, is, oh, this should have been done by the House of Representatives. This should have been done earlier. We shouldn't be considering this new, trying to get new information or consider it. Well, if you go back to what happened during Nixon, while the House Judiciary Committee voted on a bipartisan basis with seven Republicans supporting his impeachment on three grounds, the fact of the matter is that the smoking gun tape, which convinced the whole country, every Republican, that Nixon was guilty, showed him orchestrating the cover-up, that tape did not come out during the House Judiciary Committee proceedings. It came out afterwards. And I've made this point many times. To say that we can't consider after-acquired evidence, that we should be blinding ourselves to additional facts, is a joke in the light of that. That's to say that, oh, the smoking gun tape, House Judiciary Committee, you didn't get it, then we shouldn't think about it. No one ever said that. And this argument is absurd. The other argument that's coming out now that's completely a lie is the argument that the president has to commit a crime, that alleging an abuse of power is an insufficient basis for impeachment of the president. Go back to read the articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. None of those articles claim that he committed a crime. In fact, the whole second article of impeachment involves explicitly the ground of abuse of power. And everybody, every historian, every academic, just about the world recognizes that the House Judiciary Committee's proceedings against Nixon were the gold standard. So how can they say this, that you can't have impeachment for abuse of power?
My understanding,
say that with a straight face.
My understanding, that's why they brought on Alan Dershowitz, who will make maybe arguments on, I don't know, about Saturday, maybe Monday or Tuesday, that very point that you are saying, that there had to be some kind of criminal activity anyways, which is funny because it was the exact opposite thing that he said in 1999.
Well, I don't care what he said in 1991. The fact of the matter is, it is contrary not just to what scholars say, it's contrary to the precedent set in the impeachment activity of the House of Representatives. And Nixon resigned because of that. So what is he saying? It's just a lie. It's the big lie theory. If I say it often enough and I say it loudly enough, it doesn't matter. People will believe it. But I hope people understand that this is just nonsense.
I'd like to go back to your first point, because I think it's a very important one concerning the tapes, Richard Nixon's tapes that the Supreme Court ordered to be handed over. you know, that basically was a slam. That was the most smoking gun that you're going to have. And my understanding, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but basically what the Supreme Court said about being able to hear those tapes is this, that Congress, that the House of Representatives in particular, has this really enormous and awesome responsibility of having to decide whether or not to impeach a president of the United States. In other words, to try to remove a sitting president from the White House, from that position. And in order to be able to use that authority, this awesome responsibility that it has responsibly, it needs to be able to have the information to determine whether or not impeachment is appropriate. And if you are to keep that information getting to the House of Representatives, then in effect, what you are doing is you are taking away the ability to make an informed decision, a decision on something, again, that is an awesome kind of a responsibility, that of impeaching the president.
Right. Well, what you're saying is partially true, but the Supreme Court did not rule on a case that the Congress brought. The U.S. versus Nixon was a case brought by the special prosecutor.
Yeah, Jaworski.
And the Supreme Court, yes, and the Supreme Court did not, initially I think it was brought by Archibald Cox, but the Supreme Court did not rule about Congress's right to documents in an impeachment inquiry. They ruled about the right of a prosecutor in a criminal case to get evidence against from the president. And if you stop and think about it, if we're talking, of course, a criminal case against one person is extremely important. What we're talking about in impeachment is a case to protect the democracy of the United States of America, which is of huge importance. So I think that your argument that Congress needs the information to proceed in impeachment inquiry is correct, but that wasn't the ruling. In the Nixon case, the court said that those documents had to be turned over to the special prosecutor, and then we got them. They became public. But the thing is that, and that's also something that the Republicans try to obfuscate and deny. House Judiciary Committee made the same point that the House managers are making now, which is, not that the courts should have no role, but that if we had to rely on the judicial process to get the evidence, the president could stymie every impeachment inquiry. And that is just intolerable. So the House Judiciary Committee never went to court for a single document from the White House, ever. And nobody criticized it for that. And they shouldn't be, the House managers shouldn't be criticized either, because the critical thing here is if we go back to the framers, what they were trying to do in the impeachment power was to protect the democracy of the United States. And they had, because he was the point, the question was, and there's an explicit debate about this. Someone said, well, one of the delegates to the Philadelphia Convention said, well, we really need to have impeachment power. And people got up and said, what are you talking about? We don't need impeachment. We've got an election every 4 years. That should be enough. And they came back and said, we need impeachment because a president could be so dangerous in the 4 years between elections that our democracy could be at risk. That's really what impeachment is about, the risk of the threat to our democracy. And when a president puts himself above the law, when he says, I don't have to, no one has a right to investigate me, not the court, the Congress, I'm above the law. He doesn't say I'm above the law, but that's in essence it. Then you can never exercise the impeachment power. It becomes a nullity. And then our democracy is really at risk. So I think that Adam Schiff made really an extraordinary argument this morning, or I should say early this afternoon, when he really focused on what this means to our democracy to have a president abuse the power of his office, call for foreign interference, try to undermine an election, and then turn around and say, no, Congress, despite the impeachment clause in the Constitution, you can't find out anything about my conduct. You can't hold me. And it's thumbing his nose at the impeachment clause, but worse, thumbing his nose at what impeachment is designed to do, which is to protect our democracy from a president who abuses the power of his office.
Are you hopeful that the Senate will have witnesses and allow additional evidence to be used?
I'm thinking that the House is doing such a good job of showing that the president should be impeached just on the basis of the evidence they had. I don't know. It's kind of self-defeating. But and I'm just making a small joke about it, but I think they've made really an excellent case without that additional evidence for Trump's impeachment. But I do think that it's going to be very hard for the Senate to avoid, for all the Republicans to avoid calling for witnesses. And I think once you get a call for additional witnesses and documents, then you don't know what's going to happen, because one of them could be the smoking gun.
Elizabeth Holtzman is former congressional member from New York. She served in the House Judiciary Committee that investigated the Watergate scandal, helped prepare articles of impeachment that would lead to at least the resignation of President Richard Nixon. She's the author of the book, The Case for Impeaching Trump. Elizabeth Holtzman, I thank you.
Thank you.
Again, live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial. That's what we are doing. And you are listening to KPFA in Berkeley, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.FM in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and now joining us on the telephone for further analysis is John Boniface. John Boniface is a constitutional attorney, co-founder and president of Free Speech for People, and author of the book, The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. John Boniface, I thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me, and I'm the co-author with Ben Clements and Ron Fine of that book.
Appreciate the clarification. You have also been calling for the impeachment of Donald Trump now for some time. Here we are in a Senate trial. What is your sense on how the Democrat House floor managers are doing?
Well, I think the House managers are making a very powerful case as to why this president must be held accountable via the impeachment process and must be removed from office. But I also think what we saw happen yesterday in the successive votes on all the amendments that the minority leader, Senator Schumer, introduced to try to ensure that witnesses would be called, to try to ensure that documents would be demanded, to prevent this cover-up that the White House is trying to orchestrate through this impeachment trial. With those votes all going along party lines and the Republican senators preventing any calling of witnesses at this time or demanding of documents, I think it's still very much unclear whether we are going to have a real trial or whether this is going to be a kangaroo court and a sham trial. If the Republican senators in control of the Senate choose to be complicit with the criminal enterprise operating out of the Oval Office, they too will go down in history for having done this disgrace to our Constitution and to our democracy. So I think we're in a very dangerous moment where we're seeing the case being laid out by the House managers to the Senate, to the American people, but at the same time, we're dealing with the possibility this will be a sham trial.
What do you think is dangerous?
What's dangerous is that we will not have the Constitution be respected or upheld. The Constitution requires that the Senate holds a trial. A trial consists of calling witnesses, demanding documents. It doesn't consist of opening arguments and then that's it. That's not what a trial is. So it's great that we're having the opening arguments, but knowing how those votes occurred yesterday, they may be a precursor for what is lined up after these opening arguments, which is to strike down any motion for witnesses in any motion for documents. I hope certainly that there are at least four members on the Republican side who break with the Republican Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, and agree to call witnesses and have a real trial here. But if they don't, I think that danger is that we are effectively saying that the impeachment clause no longer has any effect in the Constitution, that a president can operate above the law,